This episode is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
It really is the best way to, you know, pressure test everything before exam day.
Absolutely. Okay, so imagine you just found a stock that guarantees a 500% return over the next 12 months.
Sounds like a dream.
Right. Sounds incredible. But, what if I told you there's a catch so massive, so mathematically destructive, that buying that stock could actually ruin your entire financial future?
Yeah, that's the reality of it.
Keep that in the back of your mind because we are going to tear apart exactly why that happens today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is mastering capital market theory.
The big one.
Yeah. And look, if you're looking at the Series 65 syllabus right now, you're probably doing the math and saying, well, hold on. This section is only about 2% of the exam.
Right. It's like three or four questions.
Exactly. You're thinking, I have a million other things to memorize. Can I just skim this and, you know, focus on all those heavy regulations?
You could, but honestly, it is an incredibly dangerous game to play. It's a massive mistake.
Yeah, totally. Because capital market theory isn't just a handful of isolated vocabulary words. I mean, it is the absolute bedrock of every single portfolio management decision you will ever make.
Yeah, it's a foundation.
Right. If you don't fully grasp the why and the how behind this specific unit, the entire rest of the exam, everything concerning client recommendations, risk assessment, suitability, it's going to feel like you're trying to read a foreign language in the dark.
I always tell people to think of it like the underlying physics of the financial universe.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you have to understand how gravity works before you can build a suspension bridge, right? That is what this material is. It's financial gravity.
Financial gravity. I love that. So let's lay down some ground rules for you, the listener. We know that if you just read this material straight out of textbook, it's basically a guaranteed cure for insomnia. Oh, 100%. It's so dry.
So dry. So to keep you actively locked in, we're going to cut through the noise. We're going to use vivid, slightly absurd scenarios. And we are introducing a few recurring characters today.
Which really helps it stick.
Yeah. And most importantly, we are going to ask you direct questions as we go. When we throw a question your way, I want you to actively answer it.
Say it out loud.
Yeah. Say it out loud if you're walking the dog, or just shout in your head if you're sitting on the train. Deal.
It's all about active recall. It's really the only way this information actually cements itself in your brain for exam day.
Exactly. So let's meet the cast of characters who will be joining us on this journey through the theory. First up, we have Daring Dave.
Ah.
Dave is our aggressive adrenaline junkie investor. He runs on zero sleep, way too much caffeine, and he throws all of his money into single, wildly volatile assets.
He's terrifying to advise.
Truly. Currently, he's obsessed with a startup that manufactures titanium toothpicks. He wants to hit a grand slam every single time he makes a trade. Right. So Dave is basically the walking, talking embodiment of unsystematic risk. And we'll break down exactly what that means for his bank account shortly.
On the total opposite end of the spectrum, we have cautious Carla. Carla is ultra conservative.
She loves safety.
She adores broad index funds. She practically worships U.S. Treasury bills. And her primary life goal is sleeping soundly at night without ever checking a stock ticker.
If she gets a steady, boring, predictable return, she is absolutely thrilled.
Right. Carla is our perfectly rational, risk-averse investor. She is the absolute textbook ideal for the theories we're about to explore.
The perfect client for this math.
Exactly. And finally, we have benchmark Betty. Now, Betty is an aggressive, highly ambitious portfolio manager. She works at a massive Wall Street firm, wears incredibly sharp suits, and is desperately trying to prove to her wealthy clients that she is worth her hefty 2% management fee.
She wants a parade thrown in her honor every single time she clicks buy or sell.
Oh, she demands the parade. And her entire professional existence revolves around one single metric, which is alpha.
And the math is going to reveal whether she actually earns that alpha or if she's just getting incredibly lucky.
All right, let's get into the mechanics here. I want to start with a big paradigm shift. Modern portfolio theory, or MPT.
Harry Markowitz in the 1950s.
Right. But wait, didn't he essentially just win a Nobel Prize for telling people, don't put all your eggs in one basket? I mean, my grandmother used to say that. Why is this considered a massive revolution in finance?
Well, because before Markowitz, the entire financial industry evaluated investments in a complete vacuum.
What do you mean?
Let's look at Daring Dave. If Dave brought his titanium toothpick stock to a Wall Street analyst in 1945, the analyst would only look at that one specific company.
Just the toothpicks.
Right. They'd ask, you know, is Titanium Toothpicks a good business? Do they have good management? Are their profit margins strong? It was a purely micro-level analysis.
So they evaluated the asset purely on its own individual merits.
Exactly. But Markowitz and modern portfolio theory came along and proved mathematically that this is the wrong approach entirely.
Right. It changed the fundamental question.
It did. It changed it from, is this a good stock, to how does this stock interact with all the other assets in your portfolio?
Ah.
It's not about the individual toy anymore. It's about how the toy plays with the rest of the toys in the sandbox.
Because the core principle here is maximizing your expected return for a given level of risk.
Exactly.
And this theory assumes investors are inherently rational and risk-averse, just like cautious Carla.
Right. Carla is our baseline.
I mean, if you walk up to Carla and offer her two different portfolios that both historically return 10% a year, but one of them swings wildly and gives her daily heartburn, and the other just slowly and steadily chugs along, she is taking the sleepy, steady one every single time.
Precisely. She wants the smooth ride. And the secret mechanism that MPT uses to achieve that lower risk without sacrificing the return is correlation.
Okay, let's unpack correlation, because the mechanism here is just brilliant. Correlation is a statistical scale, and it runs from negative 1.0 to positive 1.0.
Let's tie this to the real world, because the math gets abstract.
Let's do it. A perfect positive correlation, which is positive 1.0, means two assets move in exact lockstep.
Like they are handcuffed together.
Yes. Imagine buying stock in two different major airlines. If the price of jet fuel plummets, both airline stocks soar. But if a global pandemic grounds all flights, both stocks crash simultaneously.
Which means, in portfolio terms, holding both of them is completely redundant when it comes to risk.
You haven't diversified anything.
No. You've just bought two different versions of the exact same vulnerability. If tragedy strikes that specific sector, your entire portfolio burns down in perfect harmony.
It's like two people wearing sunglasses on a sunny day. Redundant. But then you have perfect negative correlation, which is negative 1.0.
This is where the magic happens.
This is the magic.
Let's say instead of buying two airlines, you buy one major airline and you buy an oil drilling company.
Now you've created a mechanical hedge. Exactly. If the price of crude oil skyrockets, the oil company makes a fortune. Its stock shoots straight up. But that same expensive oil means jet fuel costs are bankrupting the airline, so the airline stock crashes.
And conversely, if oil prices drop to basically nothing, the oil company struggles. But the airline is flying high because their biggest expense just vanished.
Right. So whatever the macroeconomic weather does, one of those assets is going to thrive, perfectly offsetting the one that is suffering. It's like one person has sunglasses, the other has an umbrella.
That is the holy grail of diversification. If one asset zigs, the other asset mathematically has to zag.
It smooths out the ride for cautious Carla. It allows her to capture growth without the massive, terrifying drops.
Okay, listener, put down your coffee for a second. Here's your first direct question. Get ready to answer.
Oh, here we go.
Let's say Daring Dave adds a new tech stock to his existing tech-heavy portfolio. And this new stock has a correlation of positive 0.9 with his current holdings.
Okay, positive 0.9.
Right. Does Dave get any diversification benefit whatsoever from adding a positive 0.9 correlation stock? Take a second.
Tell us.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
He absolutely does.
Wait, really? Because if I'm sitting there taking the exam, I am fully expecting this to be a trick.
Oh, it feels like a trick.
A positive 0.9 correlation means they move together almost perfectly. How on earth does that help him?
The exam writers love this because they want to bait you into answering that only negative correlation or zero correlation provides a diversification benefit.
Which is false.
It is entirely false. Any correlation below a perfect positive 1.0 provides a mathematical reduction in overall portfolio risk.
Just because of that tiny 0.1 difference?
Exactly. A correlation of positive 0.9 means the assets move together 90% of the time. But that 10% difference, that slight deviation where they don't behave identically,
yeah,
that mathematically smooths the curve of the portfolio's volatility. I mean, it is absolutely not as protective as a zero correlation or a negative correlation, obviously, but it still formally reduces total risk.
Okay, so burn this rule into your memory right now. If the correlation is anything less than positive 1.0, it helps. Period.
Period.
So let's visualize what all this math actually looks like. This brings us to the efficient frontier.
The efficient frontier is essentially the visual map of modern portfolio theory. I want you to close your eyes, unless you're driving, obviously, and paint a mental picture of a graph.
Okay, I'm visualizing it.
On the bottom horizontal line, the x-axis, we have risk.
Bottom is risk.
And on the vertical line going up the side, the y-axis, we have expected return.
Got it. Bottom is risk, side is return.
Now draw a sweeping upward sloping curve stretching out from the y-axis.
Like a bow.
Yeah, exactly. This curve is the efficient frontier. It represents the absolute mathematical boundary of what is possible.
The ultimate best case scenario.
Right. Every single dot that sits on that curved line represents an optimal, perfectly diversified portfolio. It means for that specific amount of risk on the bottom, you are extracting the absolute maximum expected return possible on the side.
So cautious Carla is definitely sitting right on that line.
Well, for sure.
Probably lower down, near the bottom left. She's taking very little risk, getting a lower return, but she is perfectly efficient.
Yes. And benchmark Betty, our aggressive manager, she might be plotting much further up the curve. She's taking significantly more risk to chase a higher return. But because she is a professional managing a diversified fund, she is also on the curve.
Okay, let me push back on this because this is where my intuition always gets me in trouble on these tests. Where does Daring Dave's single, highly volatile titanium toothpick stock plot on this graph?
This is a great question.
I look at a single stock like Nvidia or, you know, early Apple. They generated mind-blowing thousands of percent returns. Doesn't a high-flying single stock plot way above the efficient frontier curve because its return potential is so massive?
Think about it for a second.
It feels like it should be above the line.
It does not plot above the line. In fact, nothing plots above the curve. It is a mathematical impossibility.
Okay, you have to explain the why here.
Yeah.
Because if I bought a startup stock that went up 500%, I'm looking at this graph thinking I blew right past the boundary of the efficient frontier.
You're confusing hindsight with expected mathematical reality.
Oh, interesting.
The efficient frontier isn't a map of what did happen in the past. It's a map of risk-adjusted expectation.
Right, expectation.
An individual stock like Dave's plots inside the curve, meaning below and to the right of the line.
By below.
Because a single stock carries a massive amount of concentrated, useless, company-specific risk.
Ah, unsystematic risk.
Exactly. Dave's toothpick factory could literally catch fire tomorrow. The CEO could get caught embezzling funds. A new competitor could invent a better toothpick. That specific concentrated risk does not guarantee you any extra return. The portfolios that sit on the efficient frontier are fully diversified. They have mathematically scrubbed out all of that useless, unsystematic company risk through correlation.
And Dave hasn't done that.
No, Dave is raw-dogging the risk.
So because Dave is taking on all this extra uncompensated risk on the x-axis, his expected return on the y-axis is actually terrible compared to what he could get if he just held a diversified portfolio with that exact same level of total risk.
Precisely. So to summarize the rule for the exam, single, undiversified stocks plot inside the curve. Perfectly diversified portfolios plot on the curve.
And nothing plots above.
Absolutely nothing plots above the curve. It is the absolute ceiling of financial gravity.
Nothing plots above. Got it. All right. Hey, pattern interrupt. If you are staring at traffic right now or your mind is wandering to what you're making for dinner tonight, refocus.
I'll go back to us.
Snap back to me. Because this next distinction is arguably the single biggest trap on the Series 65. We are talking about the two completely different faces of risk. Standard deviation versus beta.
This is where we separate the professionals from the amateurs.
Yep.
You cannot just use the word risk generically anymore. You have to know precisely what kind of risk each metric is measuring and exactly how they behave.
Let's start with the big one, which is standard deviation. Standard deviation measures total risk.
Total risk.
And by total, we mean absolutely everything. The macroeconomic forces plus the tiny company-specific disasters, systematic plus unsystematic.
Right. This is the exact metric that applies to Daring Dave's single stock.
Because it's a single stock.
Yeah. Because Dave's stock is completely undiversified, he is fully exposed to every single type of risk in existence. If the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, his stock drops. That's systematic.
But also if his titanium supplier goes bankrupt, his stock drops. That's unsystematic.
Exactly. Standard deviation captures all of that chaotic volatility, both internal and external, in one single number.
And here's where the math gets heavily tested. Standard deviation assumes that a stock's historical returns follow a normal distribution, the classic bell curve.
You have to know the curve.
I know you know this, but break down the empirical rule for me. Where do the numbers actually fall?
You must have these three numbers memorized for the exam. 68, 95, 99.7.
68, 95, 99.7.
In a perfectly normal distribution, 68% of a stock's historical returns will fall within one standard deviation of its historical average.
Okay.
95% of the returns will fall within two standard deviations. And 99.7% will fall within three standard deviations.
Okay, let's do some slow audio math right here, because I guarantee you this is a test question. Listener, get your mental calculator ready.
Walk us through it.
Let's pretend you are looking at a mutual fund. It has a historical average return, a mean of 10%, and it has a standard deviation of 5%. What is the 95% probability range for its returns next year?
Okay, pause and think about it.
Let's walk through the logic step by step.
All right, the question specifically asked for the 95% probability range. Based on the rule we just learned, 95% always equals two standard deviations.
Right. 68 is one, 95 is two.
The standard deviation provided in the question was 5%. Since we need two of them, we multiply 2 times 5%, which gives us 10%.
Okay, so I have my 10% buffer.
Now, we take our baseline mean return, which was also 10%, and we go plus or minus that 10% buffer we just calculated. So 10% minus 10% is 0%, and 10% plus 10% is 20%.
So we can say with 95% mathematical confidence that next year, this fund will return somewhere between a worst case of 0% and a best case of 20%.
Exactly. That is how you quantify total risk using standard deviation. It's beautiful math.
It is beautiful. Now let's look at the other face of risk, beta. If standard deviation is the messy kitchen sink metric of total risk, beta is the highly refined isolated risk.
Beta measures systematic risk only.
Systematic only.
Market risk. The macroeconomic risk that you absolutely cannot diversify away, no matter how many stocks you buy. This is the metric that applies to cautious Carla.
Because she owns the index fund.
Right. Remember, Carla owns a perfectly diversified S&P 500 index fund. She has mathematically scrubbed away all company-specific risk. If the CEO of one of those 500 companies gets caught in a scandal and fired, her portfolio barely blinks because the other 499 companies hold it up.
The only risk Carla faces is if the entire U.S. economy takes a hit. That is systematic risk, and that is strictly what beta measures.
And you have to know the baseline.
Right. The baseline benchmark for beta is the overall market, which is always assigned a value of exactly 1.0.
Always 1.0.
So let's run through the scenarios. If benchmark Betty builds a portfolio with a beta of 1.2, what does that actually mean for the client's money?
It means it is 20% more volatile than the overall market. It's an aggressive posture.
So if the market goes up?
If the S&P 500 goes up 10%, Betty's portfolio should theoretically go up 12%. But if the market drops 10%, Betty's clients are losing 12%.
What if beta is less than 1, like 0.8?
That's a defensive posture. It's 20% less volatile than the market. If the market drops 10%, this portfolio only drops 8%. Cautious Carla might really prefer a portfolio like this to cushion the blow during a recession.
And what if the beta is exactly 0?
That means there is absolutely no correlation to the stock market's movements whatsoever. You're looking at cash or short-term treasury bills.
Just sitting there?
Literally. The entire global stock market could crash 50% tomorrow, and your T-bill is just sitting there, completely unfazed, earning its small yield.
And what if beta is negative, like a negative 1.0?
That means it moves in the exact opposite direction of the market with the exact same magnitude.
Yeah.
This is incredibly rare in traditional stocks.
Yeah, you don't really see that naturally.
No, you generally only see this with certain precious metal funds.
Yeah.
Or specifically engineered inverse ETFs that use derivatives to intentionally go up when the market crashes.
Okay, here comes a major, major conceptual trap. Listen to me carefully on this one. Is it possible for a single stock to have a really low beta, let's say a beta of 0.5, but simultaneously have a massive, terrifying standard deviation?
Take a beat to think about that.
Yes, it is entirely possible, and it happens all the time.
It happens constantly.
But wait, how does that make sense? If the beta is only 0.5, shouldn't that mean it's a really safe, non-volatile, defensive stock?
No, and this is exactly where people fail the exam. You have to remember the definitions. Beta only measures systematic risk. It only measures how the stock reacts to the overall market. Let's look at Dave's titanium toothpick stock. Maybe the toothpick industry doesn't really care what the S&P 500 is doing. Its beta is low. But internally,
it's a mess.
The company is a complete disaster. They're constantly getting sued, their factory equipment keeps breaking, and their earnings are wildly unpredictable.
Its company-specific risk is through the roof.
Exactly. So its standard deviation, which measures total risk, including all that internal chaos, is massive. But its beta is low. You cannot conflate the two metrics.
So how does the exam test this?
If the exam asks you to evaluate the risk of a highly diversified mutual fund, you use beta because the unsystematic risk has been removed. But if the exam asks you to evaluate the risk of a single undiversified stock, you must use standard deviation.
Because you have to account for that internal company-specific chaos.
Right. Beta for the diversified, standard deviation for the individual.
Got it. Let's transition to how we actually use these risk metrics to figure out how much money we should be making. This is the capital asset pricing model, or CAPM.
The famous CAPM.
And this is where Benchmark Betty goes on her quest for alpha. Break down the concept of CAPM for me, not with the crazy algebra, but with the actual real-world logic.
Simply put, CAPM is a mathematical formula that tells you exactly how much return you should expect to get, based precisely on how much systematic risk you are taking.
It's like a pricing menu.
It is the pricing mechanism for risk.
Okay, the math notation looks incredibly intimidating on paper. It's expected return equals the risk-free rate plus beta multiplied by the market risk premium. E of R equals RF plus beta times RM minus RF. It looks like a foreign language.
That scares a lot of people.
But let's use the couch money analogy because I think it strips away all the academic noise.
Walk us through couch money.
The risk-free rate, that RF in the formula, is usually a 91-day U.S. Treasury bill. I call this couch money. This is the guaranteed return you get for literally doing nothing. You can sit on your couch, take absolutely zero risk of default, and the U.S. government will pay you this baseline interest rate.
It is your absolute floor. You should never, ever invest a single dollar in anything risky if it doesn't at least pay you more than couch money.
Right. So if you are going to get off the couch and take a risk by putting your money into the volatile stock market, you demand a bonus. You demand to be mathematically compensated for your bravery.
Exactly.
That bonus is called the market risk premium. It is the expected return of the overall market minus your couch money.
Hmm.
And then you multiply that bonus by your specific risk multiplier, which is your beta.
Let's do the audio math on this. We will take this slow. Listener, stay with us. Visualize the dollars if it helps. Let's say the risk-free rate, the couch money, is 3%.
3%.
The expected return of the overall broad stock market is 10%. And Benchmark Betty has built a portfolio for her clients with a beta of 1.2. She's taking 20% more systematic risk than the market. Based on CAPM, what is her acquired expected return?
Okay, step by step. First, what is the market risk premium? How big is the bonus for getting off the couch? It's the market return of 10% minus the couch money of 3%.
Right.
So the market is offering a 7% premium for taking baseline market risk.
Correct. Now, Betty isn't taking baseline market risk. She has a beta of 1.2. She took more risk.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't just get the 7% premium. She requires 1.2 times that 7% premium.
Let me do the math. 1.2 times 7 is 8.4%.
Right. So her required bonus for the specific amount of risk she took is 8.4%. Finally, we have to add back the baseline couch money that she would have gotten anyway for sitting around. 8.4% premium plus the 3% risk-free rate equals 11.4%.
11.4%. That is her CAPM expected return. The math gods have decreed that for taking on a beta of 1.2, Betty must earn 11.4% to justify the risk she took.
That's her hurdle.
But wait. The year ends, the market closes, and Benchmark Betty actually got her clients a 14% return.
And she is demanding her parade. She wants her 2% management fee, a massive year-end bonus, and a feature profile in a financial magazine.
But hold on, let me look at this like a naive investor. Betty got 14%. The overall market only returned 10%. She beat the market by 4%. So she generated 4% alpha, right? Give her the parade.
Think about this, listener. Is it 4%?
Is it?
Absolutely not. And if you click 4% on the exam, you fail that question.
Oh, wow.
They will put 4% as answer choice A, just sitting there looking incredibly obvious and tempting. Do not click it.
Wait, why? 14 minus 10 is 4. She beat the market.
Because alpha is not just how much did you beat the market by. Alpha is How much did you beat your risk-adjusted expectation by?
Oh, the expectation.
We just spent 5 minutes calculating that because Betty took on extra amplified risk with a beta of 1.2, she was supposed to earn 11.4%. She didn't take normal market level risk, so we cannot compare her to the 10% normal market return.
Right.
That's comparing apples to highly volatile oranges.
Oh, we have to compare her actual return to her specific CAPM expected return.
Exactly.
Her actual return was 14%. Her CAPM expected return was 11.4%. So 14 minus 11.4 equals a positive 2.6%. That is her true alpha plus 2.6%.
Betty did add value. She beat the math. But she only added 2.6% of pure value, not 4%. She was compensated for the extra risk she took. And then her actual stock picking skill delivered an extra 2.6% on top of that.
That is what alpha actually represents.
Yes, it's the manager's pure skill, entirely isolated from the risk they took.
So if Betty had taken all that 1.2 beta risk and returned exactly 11.4%, her alpha would be exactly zero.
Yes. She performed exactly as the APM predicted she would for the risk she took. No parade for Betty. She didn't add any value through skill. She just rode the risk curve.
And if she returned 10%, she actually has a negative alpha, even though she tied the overall market return because she exposed her clients to way more risk to get the same result.
And that is a critical, profound concept to understand for managing real client money. You have to adjust for risk before you evaluate performance.
Okay, but what if the tool we are using to measure that risk is fundamentally broken?
Now we're getting to the fun stuff.
This brings us to a concept called R squared. I want to set up a scenario. We just used KAPM and the beta of the S&P 500 to judge benchmark Betty. But what if Betty isn't managing a broad, diversified U.S. equity portfolio?
Okay.
What if Betty is managing a highly concentrated niche fund that only invests in South African gold mining companies? But her boss at the Wall Street firm is still using the S&P 500's beta to judge her performance for her annual review.
Well, her boss is making a massive statistical error. The S&P 500 is a broad measure of the U.S. economy. South African gold miners are going to march to the beat of an entirely different drum. Their stock price movements are going to be driven by the global price of gold, regional geopolitical events, local mining regulations, labor strikes, things the S&P 500 doesn't care about at all.
So if her boss forces a software program to calculate a beta for Betty's gold fund relative to the S&P 500, a number is going to spit out of the calculator, but it's going to be basically meaningless.
It's the definition of garbage in, garbage out.
Huh.
And this is precisely where R squared comes to the rescue. R squared acts as a statistical lie detector test for beta.
A lie detector test. I love that framing. Explain the mechanics.
R squared measures how much of a portfolio's price movement is actually explained by the movements of the benchmark index you are comparing it to. It operates on a scale of 0 to 100, or 0.0 to 1.0.
So let's look at cautious Carla. Carla owns an S&P 500 index fund, and we are comparing it to the S&P 500 benchmark.
The R squared is going to be nearly 100%. Every single time her fund moves up or down, it's because the benchmark moved. They are identical twins. The polygraph test comes back perfectly clean. Beta is fully reliable.
Correct. But if we run the R-squared polygraph on Betty's niche gold mining fund compared to the S&P 500, the R-squared might come back at, say, 30%.
Meaning only 30% of her fund's movements can be explained by what the U.S. stock market is doing.
Right. The other 70% of the movement is totally unrelated.
The polygraph is flashing red. The beta is lying to you.
So what's the rule for the exam?
You absolutely need to know the threshold. If R squared is below 70 or 0.7, zero beta is considered completely statistically unreliable. You cannot use it to calculate CAPM expected return. You cannot use it to measure risk. You take beta and you throw it in the trash.
So here is my direct question to you, listener. Think back to our discussion a few minutes ago. If R squared is low and beta is lying to you and belongs in the trash, what risk metric do we have to use instead to evaluate Betty's fund?
Think about what else we have.
What's the alternative?
You have to go back to total risk. You have to use standard deviation.
Yes, because if the broad benchmark isn't explaining the fund's movements, it means there is a massive amount of unsystematic, idiosyncratic risk happening inside that fund.
Which beta ignores.
Right. As we established, beta is completely blind to unsystematic risk. Standard deviation, however, sees everything. So if R squared is low, swap out beta for standard deviation.
Notice how all these concepts interlock. The exam will test this exact logical flow in a single question. Low R squared means low correlation to the benchmark, which means beta is useless, which means you must measure total risk using standard deviation.
It's all connected. It's beautiful. All right, we are moving into the ultimate showdown. If you are taking notes, draw a line down the middle of the page.
Oh, boy.
On the left side, write SML, the security market line. On the right side, write CML, the capital market line. Why in the world do we have two things that sound exactly the same, look like lines on a graph, and test completely different concepts?
Because finance academics in the 1960s had a terrible sense of branding.
Clearly.
It's a high-frequency trap on the exam, simply because it's so incredibly easy to confuse the acronyms under pressure. We need to do a direct side-by-side comparison of their mechanics.
Let's do it. Let's look at the x-axis first. When you draw the graph for each of these lines, what metric is sitting on the bottom horizontal line?
For the security market line, the SML, the x-axis is beta. It measures systematic risk. For the capital market line, the CML, the x-axis, is standard deviation. It measures total risk.
Let me stop you right there, because this is an evil trap. SML stands for security market line. It starts with an S. Standard deviation also starts with an S. Do they go together?
Absolutely not. Do not fall for the alliteration trap. SML uses beta. CML uses standard deviation.
Okay, what about the audience? Who is allowed to be evaluated on these lines?
The SML is highly inclusive. It evaluates everything. You can plot Cautious Carla's perfectly diversified index fund, and you can plot Daring Dave's single garbage titanium toothpick stock. The SML doesn't care. It will evaluate any asset based purely on its systematic risk, ignoring the internal chaos.
But the CML is like an exclusive VIP club.
Exactly. The CML only evaluates perfectly diversified, efficient portfolios. Individual stocks are strictly not allowed on the CML.
Why not?
Because the CML uses standard deviation on its x-axis, and it inherently assumes that all unsystematic risk has already been diversified away. If you hold a single stock with unsystematic risk, you aren't efficient, and you plot below the CML.
Okay, let's talk about the slope of these lines, the steepness of the line. This gets a little mathy, but we need to understand the mechanism.
The slope of the SML is simply the market risk premium, that RM minus RF bonus we talked about in the CAPM formula.
But the slope of the CML is determined by something called the Sharpe ratio of the market portfolio. We need a quick Sharpe ratio refresher here because it ties this whole concept together beautifully. William Sharpe created this to solve a specific problem, right?
He did. The Sharpe ratio is a measure of risk-adjusted return. It answers a very specific question for investors. How much excess return am I getting for every single unit of total risk I endure?
Okay.
The formula is the portfolio's actual total return minus the risk-free rate. So your excess return divided by the portfolio's standard deviation.
Let's pause on the math mechanism there. Why are we dividing by standard deviation?
Think of dividing by standard deviation as applying a mathematical penalty for a bumpy ride. If two funds both return 10%, but fund A does it smoothly and fund B looks like a roller coaster, fund B is going to have a much larger standard deviation.
Right.
When you divide that 10% return by a larger number, the overall Sharpe ratio shrinks. The math actively penalizes the volatile fund, revealing that the smooth fund is superior on a risk-adjusted basis.
Again, standard deviation. So the CML uses standard deviation on its x-axis, and its slope is defined by the Sharpe ratio, which mathematically relies on standard deviation. It's incredibly consistent. Total risk, total risk, total risk. That is the CML's entire brand.
It is. Total risk for the CML. Systematic risk for the SML.
Okay, let's talk about the biggest conceptual trap of all in this area, the SML valuation trap. Listen closely. Let's say we are looking at the security market line graph. It's an upward sloping line. You plot Daring Dave's newest stock pick on the graph, and the dot plots above the SML line. Direct question for you, listener. Is Dave's stock currently overvalued or undervalued in the market?
Take a second. Above the line.
What do you think?
It is undervalued. It is a massive bargain. You should buy it immediately.
I'm going to push back hard on this. This is wildly counterintuitive. In almost every other area of life and finance, if a price is above the line or off the charts, we think it's too expensive. It's overvalued. Why on earth is it undervalued here?
You have to think about what the y-axis actually represents on this specific graph. The y-axis is expected return.
Okay.
The SML line represents exactly what the CAPM formula says a stock should return for its exact level of risk. It's the fair baseline. If a stock plots above that line, it means it is offering a higher return than the CAPM formula formally requires.
It's giving you more bang for your buck.
Exactly. If the CAPM math says a stock with a beta of 1.0 should fairly give you a 10% return, but Dave finds a stock with a beta of 1.0 that is currently priced so well that it's poised to give you a 12% return, that stock is sitting vertically above the SML.
It is offering a premium.
It has positive alpha.
So because it's offering such an unusually great return for the risk, it means the current asking price of the stock is too low. It's on sale. It is undervalued.
Yes. You want to buy that stock before everyone else on Wall Street realizes it's cheap, buys it up, and drives the price higher, which would eventually push the return back down onto the line.
And conversely, if a stock plots below the SML, it means it's offering a worse return than it mathematically should for the risk you're taking. It's a ripoff. It's overvalued. Sell it or avoid it entirely.
I tell students to make this a mantra. Above equals undervalued. Buy it. Say it over and over until the counterintuitive nature of it fades away. It is a heavily tested concept.
Above equals undervalued. Got it. All right, we are rounding the final corner into the macro theory that governs all of this. The efficient market hypothesis, or EMH. The big existential question here is, are all of these calculations pointless? Is Benchmark Betty completely wasting her time and stealing her clients' money with that 2% fee?
The efficient market hypothesis is a massive academic framework that essentially argues that financial markets are incredibly efficient, ruthlessly fast information processing machines. It states that current security prices fully and instantly reflect all available information.
So by the time Daring Dave gets a hot stock tip from his brother-in-law at a barbecue or reads a bullish article on a financial blog, thousands of supercomputers and algorithmic trading bots on Wall Street have already digested that information, bought or sold the stock millions of times, and moved the price to exactly where it should fairly be.
The news is already priced in.
Exactly. And if all information is already priced in instantly, it means that nobody can consistently beat the market through skill. Finding an undervalued stock, like we just talked about with the SML, is theoretically impossible because the second it becomes undervalued, the market algorithms instantly buy it and correct the price back to the line before a human can even click their mouse.
But the theory isn't just one monolithic rule. It has nuance. There are three distinct forms of EMH, and I like to think of them as Russian nesting dolls of information, each one encompassing the last. Let's open the smallest innermost doll.
The smallest doll is the weak form of EMH.
Right. Weak form states that all past market and trading data, things like historical prices, trading volume, moving averages, are already fully reflected in today's stock price.
So what does that mean for an investor's strategy?
It means technical analysis is totally useless. Looking at stock charts, trying to find head and shoulders patterns or support levels based on past price movements is a complete waste of time. The market has already priced all of that historical data in.
But what about deeper research?
Under the weak form, fundamental analysis, deeply reading balance sheets, analyzing a company's profit margins and cash flow might still work to give you an edge because maybe the broader market hasn't fully digested that deeper, complex public data yet.
Okay, let's open the second, slightly bigger Russian nesting doll, the semi-strong form.
Semi-strong form swallows the weak form entirely and adds to it. It states that prices reflect all past trading data, PLUS, all publicly available information, earnings reports, news headlines, macroeconomic data, SEC filings, press releases. The literal second a company announces its quarterly earnings, the stock price adjusts in milliseconds to reflect that new public reality.
So under semi-strong, technical analysis is useless, and the fundamental analysis is totally useless.
Yes.
Daring Dave can't look at a chart to get an edge, and Benchmark Betty can't read a balance sheet fast enough to beat the supercomputers. Betty's entire job of picking undervalued stocks is essentially obsolete.
Right. And I will note right here for the exam, semi-strong is the most widely accepted form of the theory among modern academics, and it is overwhelmingly the most heavily tested version on the Series 65 exam.
So if neither technical nor fundamental analysis works under semi-strong, does anything work? How do you beat the market?
Only one thing works. Insider information. Secret, non-public information that the market physically does not have access to yet. If Dave secretly knows the CEO of his titanium toothpick company is going to resign tomorrow and hasn't been announced anywhere, he has an edge. He can trade on it before the market prices it in.
Which brings us to the biggest, outermost Russian nesting doll. The strong form.
Strong form is the extreme absolute version. It states that prices reflect absolutely All information, past data, public news, AND, private, insider information.
Wow.
It argues that markets are so profoundly, almost supernaturally efficient that even the corporate insiders can't beat the market. Because somehow, through subtle trading behaviors or supply chain leaks, that secret information has already leaked into the price action. Under strong form, nobody can beat the market. Ever.
Okay, let's test this knowledge. We've got two big exam traps here. First, let's say a test question describes a dedicated investor who spends all weekend poring over corporate financial statements and 10K filings to pick undervalued stocks. Which form of EMH does this investor believe in?
Ooh, this is a tricky one. Think about it.
They believe the market is not semi-strong efficient.
Exactly.
Think about it. If they believed in semi-strong, they would know that reading those public statements is a waste of time because it's already priced in. They must believe the market is only weak form efficient, which leaves fundamental analysis as a viable, profitable strategy.
I love the reverse logic there.
Okay, second trap. Direct question to you, listener. Think about the real world. Does the existence of SEC insider trading laws and people actually going to prison for it prove or disprove the strong form of EMH?
Take a beat. Prove or disprove?
It absolutely disproves it. It is the ultimate evidence against the strong form.
Explain the logic for the listener on that.
If the strong form were completely true and all secret information was already magically priced into the stock the moment it existed, an insider like Daring Dave couldn't make any excess money trading on his secrets. The price would have already moved. If he couldn't make money, the SEC wouldn't need to spend millions of dollars enforcing laws to make insider trading illegal. The very fact that people get rich from insider trading and consequently go to jail for it proves that insiders do have an information advantage that isn't priced in yet. Therefore, strong form cannot be a perfect reflection of reality.
That is such a beautifully logical way to remember it. The laws exist because the strong form is false.
So if we take all of this modern portfolio theory, CAPM, the efficient market hypothesis, what is the ultimate grand takeaway for how people should actually invest their money? If markets are mostly efficient, is Benchmark Betty just wasting her time and charging her clients a 2% fee for pure luck?
Ultimately, the efficient market hypothesis acts as the academic foundation for passive management. If semi-strong EMH is true, and most evidence suggests it largely is in highly developed markets, actively picking stocks is a fool's errand. Betty might beat the market 1 year by pure luck, but over a 20-year horizon, her 2% management fee will act as a massive drag, and she will underperform the benchmark.
So what's the answer?
The theoretically optimal strategy, according to the culmination of capital market theory, is cautious Carlos strategy. Buy a highly diversified, low-cost index fund, sit back, accept the market return, and go to sleep.
Wow. We just systematically dismantled Betty's entire Wall Street career in one segment using math. Okay, we have covered a massive, sprawling amount of ground today. It is time for the rapid fire recap. We are going to fire off the top five non-negotiable, heavily tested takeaways from everything we just discussed. Burn these into your brain. Ready?
Let's lock it in.
Number one, know your risk metrics. Beta strictly equals systematic risk. Standard deviation strictly equals total risk. Never mix them up. Single stocks use standard deviation. Diversified funds use beta.
Number two, polygraph test. Got a low R squared, specifically under 70. Throw beta in the trash. It's a statistical liar. You must pivot and use standard deviation to measure the risk instead.
Number three, the SML valuation trap. If a stock plots above the upward sloping security market line, it is offering more return than it should. It is undervalued. Buy it immediately.
Number four, don't fall for the acronyms. CML uses standard deviation and only evaluates perfectly efficient, diversified portfolios. SML uses beta and evaluates everything under the sun.
Number five, semi-strong EMH is the most heavily tested form. It asserts that all public info is instantly priced in, making fundamental analysis totally useless, meaning you should probably just embrace passive management and buy an index fund.
A perfect distillation of the theory.
To close this out, leave us with something to chew on. We've talked so much about this theoretical mathematical perfection, the smooth, efficient frontier, perfectly priced markets, exact standard deviations. Give us a final provocative thought to take with us into the real world.
Here is a concept to mull over as you study. We talk extensively about the efficient market hypothesis, where supercomputers and algorithmic bots are digesting new global information, a war breaking out, an inflation report, a CEO resignation, and pricing it in every millisecond of every single day. If that is true, doesn't that mean the efficient frontier of modern portfolio theory, that perfect smooth curve we mentally drew on the graph, is actually violently vibrating and shifting thousands of times a second as prices instantly react to the news.
Oh, wow.
And if that perfect target is constantly vibrating, is it ever actually possible for a human being to hold a truly optimal portfolio in real time? Or are we all just permanently chasing mathematical ghosts in the machine?
Oh, that is haunting. We are just chasing ghosts in the machine while the algorithms do the real work. I love that. Think about that vibrating curve next time you look at a stock chart. All right, that is our deep dive into capital market theory. Review your notes. Remember the difference between Dave's chaos and Carla's index funds. Keep drilling those practice questions and go crush the exam. You've got this.